Welcome to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exists to help people find their way back to God. This week, we're continuing our series called Heroes and Villains. But before we get to this week's message, we wanted to let you know that yesterday, we spent some time with Pastor Tierra discussing all of the new upcoming discipleship opportunities that will be happening at and through South Harbor Church. If you're curious about places to get involved, studies you can join, groups to become a part of, or questions you might have about any of those things, feel free to contact us at shinfo@harborchurches.org, or you can email Pastor Tierra directly at tierra.marshall@harborchurches.org. You can also sign up for our weekly email, which will be a continuing place for the latest information about the things that you can become involved in. To sign up, find the button on our homepage at southharbor.org, or shoot us an email at shinfo@harborchurches.org, and we'll be sure to get you on the list. And now, let's go to Pastor Tim for this week's message as we consider whether or not Noah is a hero or a villain.
If you have a Bible, we're going to be in Genesis chapter 8, if you want to join along. Genesis chapter 8, the slide says 1 through 12. That'll make sense in a moment because we'll kind of cover a lot of ground, but we're going to lock in on Genesis 8. Genesis 8 is the story of a man named Noah. So we introduced a new series last week, and we called the series Heroes and Villains. And really the goal behind the series is humanity is complex. And what we'll often do with the scriptures is we will take certain people and say, this person's a hero. And other people will say, well, this person's a villain. And we can almost treat the Bible like a Disney movie, right? Where very clear good guys and very clear bad guys. But when you actually start reading the scriptures, you realize that the stories are far more complex. The characters, the people are far, because people are complex. And so we wanted to just take some time and look at some of these like famous stories and unpack them a little bit. Today we're going to look at the story of Noah. Noah is, I don't know about you, but I grew up singing certain songs about Noah. Do anybody remember the songs you sang about Noah? How about this one? God said to Noah, there's going to be a floody. God said to Noah, I didn't expect this. It's going to be a floody. Get those animals, reindeer. I always want to say reindeer. I don't know why, but get those animals out of the muddy children of the Lord. And then my wife introduced me. I didn't know this guy existed until we got married, and now we're raising our kids on the soundtrack of, is it Rafi or Raffi? Rafi? Do you know the song, Who Built the Ark? Noah, who built the ark? Brother Noah built the ark. Yeah, so we know the story of Noah, especially as if we grew up in the church at all. You've heard the songs, you know the stories. Maybe you're reading, if you've got little ones, you're reading the kids' picture Bibles. Noah is really the only story of apparently God-sanctioned mass genocide that we share with our children. So what do we do with a story like Noah? When I stand back from the story of Noah, it's one of those stories where I can map and chart my own spiritual growth and the questions I was asking at the time. It kind of runs a parallel path of the questions I was asking about Noah. So there's certain moments in life where all of a sudden like new questions would arise, and along the way, those questions would relate to the story of Noah. So for instance, it was sometime around the age of 7, 8, 9, somewhere in there, where I remember listening to I think it was a kid's sermon at church, and they were talking about Noah, and I remember thinking, okay, well, the story makes sense. Okay, all the animals got saved by going in a boat. That makes sense. But what didn't make sense to me at the time, I remember very distinctly thinking, what happened to the plants? Because my grandpa was a hobby farmer, and so he was a farmer by trade, and then he retired, and he had this little hobby farm on some land we had in. And I remember very distinctly growing up and knowing that if the rain came down too hard and it flooded out the fields, those plants are gone. They're not coming back. Once overwatered, they're not coming back. So I remember thinking, okay, so the animals get saved, the people get saved by going on the boat, but what about the vegetation? And I remember my Sunday school teacher being like, go ask your mom and dad. So that was like 7, 8, 9-year-old me. And then flash forward a little bit to like that 15, 16, 17 period of time. And I remember the question, so a pastor was preaching, and this pastor, I won't say which pastor, he's a lovely man, but he said something along the lines of, and as we all know, this is the point in history where the dinosaurs went extinct. And I remember thinking, really? We know this? Really? And I was a little bit like already a little bit cynical, but I'm hearing this and thinking, this is where the dinosaur, this guy knows that that's true. Is that in the story? And I had a clear sense at that age that there are certain questions that if you ask them, it'll lead you into some dangerous territory. I remember having this distinct, okay, if I'm gonna say yes to the faith, I'm gonna have to say no to my brain. It was like, it felt like a split in me. It was either I was going to engage my mind, engage my brain, study, learn, or I was gonna be a follower of Jesus and read the Bible. And it was a false distinction. But it felt at the time like I had to choose. And I remember thinking, well, if this is the case, you choose intellectual integrity, right? Like you choose that. And so it was one of those moments where I had the distinct, a few well-placed questions and the whole thing might topple. It's best that I just not ask the questions. That was somewhere around 15, 16, 17-year-old me. When I was 21, I stumbled upon the stories of Jesus. I had read these stories in church. I'd heard the stories, but I didn't actually read the stories until I was like 21. And I was hooked. I was hooked. Jesus kept saying things like, remember this phrase, like leapt out at me. Love the Lord your God with all of your mind. Our mind? Jesus would say things like, come, open your eyes to see and open your mind to understand. And it was not a closing of the mind. I didn't have to be closed-minded according to Jesus. To be a follower of Jesus was somebody who was actually like asking all the questions and observing all the things. That was sometime around the 21 point. When I was 22, like, so that insight led me to like really pursue understanding and learning and growth. And so when I was 22, I had this idea. I was really big into art and drawing at the time. And I had this idea that if I'm going to know the story, the biblical stories well, the best thing I could do is draw them, which, by the way, was a fantastic instinct. Because when you draw a story, it requires you to ask all the right questions. If you're ever stuck on a biblical passage and you're like, I don't know where to go from here, draw it. Seriously, try it. Like, you'll ask all the right questions. Who was there? Where did this happen? Why did it play out like this? All the right, how old were they when this happened? Like, you have to ask all the right questions. But I got to the Noah story and I remember draw it. And if I'm honest, like, you draw it and if you're reading the story and like tracking with the story, okay, you're gonna put some, you have two of every kind, get on a boat, a few extra for the sacrifices. But then you've got a flood and all the other stuff is washed up. So you've got a boat on top of water, and then what's in the water? What do you do with all the violence? That was my question at the age of 22. What do you do with all that? Cute story, as told, like, every kid loves to think about little animals going in a boat, but what do you do with the rest of it? I was 22. 23-year-old me was in seminary, and I had this great professor, and I didn't know this, but this professor was sharing with me how, as you all know, she said something along those lines, there were other flood stories. In fact, most ancient cultures had a flood story, and Jesus' neighbors had flood stories. In fact, there is a neighbor, like some neighbors of the Hebrew people that had a flood story. They're from Mesopotamia. It's the land Abraham comes from. And this flood story known as the Epic of Gilgamesh. Have you heard of the Epic of Gilgamesh? Anyone? The Epic of Gilgamesh is almost exactly the same. Almost exactly the same as the Noah story. Almost the same. And get this, the Epic of Gilgamesh predates the Noah story. It was written first. Now, I remember she like said this and like we were kind of scandalized by that. Like, what? What? Why don't they teach this? And she said, no, we're scandalized because for whatever reason, we don't say that. But they knew what their stories were. The people that first passed around these stories knew what stories their neighbors were telling. They knew the stories their neighbors were telling. And then she said, the secret to understanding what is like really going on in the Noah story that God's trying to grab our shirt collars and tell us, the secret is to compare the two stories because they're similar, but there are some really, really crucial differences. That was sometime around seminary. I fell in love with context and exploring the history of the, like, where this stuff happens, and you realize there's all these, like, innuendos and inside jokes, and, like, I still am obsessed with knowing those things. Okay, so flash forward to 31-year-old me. I was I was pastor of a church called South Harbor, a little church in Byron Center, South Harbor Church. Still here. And a movie came out. Some of you remember this movie. It was the movie, they just called it Noah, and it starred Russell, are you not entertained, Crowe from Gladiator, you know, Russell Crowe. Emma Hermione Granger, Emma Watson, and then Jennifer Connelly. I actually met Jennifer Connelly. It's a wild story. I was walking a puppy in Zealand, and she was filming a movie, and I'm like, I think I know you. It was Jennifer Connelly. So some big actors and actresses in this movie, and yet, if you've seen the movie, just my opinion, it was not a good movie. It went on too long. It was not a good movie. But I mean, it was like if you watched any of the Adam Sandler movies for Netflix, that bad. It was like that kind of, in my opinion. I'm glad it was made for one reason and one reason alone. There was a review that came out, and a critic review, and the review was by a rabbi, and the rabbi said something that I didn't know. Reviewing the movie, like talking about, basically the rabbi said, I don't know anything about cinematography, I'm not the best person to ask about acting, I'll let that for the professional movie critics. But as a rabbi, what the movie got right is, as all Jewish people know, Noah is not a hero. I remember hearing that thinking, wait, what? Noah's not a hero. Doesn't the story itself say that Noah's a hero? In fact, the opening of the story, Genesis 6 verse 9. This is the account of Noah and his family. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. Righteous, blameless, walk. Like, doesn't the story say that Noah is a righteous man? Well, surely he blows it then, and God says you're no longer righteous. Well, does he? Because there's not. Yeah, there's a moment after the flood and that whole story where he gets drunk and passes out. But like, is that one moment enough to say, well, this guy's not good? Why would the rabbi say this? But so that led me on a hunt to figure out why would the rabbi say this. Sure enough, why this rabbi said this, turns out that the Jewish people actually will say that Noah's not a hero. Noah's not a hero. According to their read of the story, Noah's not a hero. They even tell a story. And the story, it's known as Midrash. Midrash is kind of like the parables. It's a story that's not in the Bible, but it's trying to highlight a detail that is in the Bible. So it's a made-up story told by the rabbis to highlight a truth that's in the scriptures that maybe we wouldn't see unless they highlighted it. And the story goes like this. As we all know, the reason Noah was not a hero is because Noah wore a fur coat. End scene. And it's like, wait, time out, what? And now that little story that created all kinds of dialogue of, what do you mean Noah wore a fur coat? It's not in the text. There's no story of Noah wearing a fur coat. What? That was when I was, like 31 here. By the way, if I don't get to the fur coat story because I'm running long, like the Noah movie, let me know. I'll fill you in. 38-year-old me. So, I'm now 38. This brings me to today. And I was looking at all of this and the Noah story in particular. This was actually when I was 37, kind of the days of COVID, early COVID. And just seeing how much damage can happen when we misinterpret the Bible, and just seeing that play out in front of my eyes and like feeling completely powerless to like correct everyone's social media account. Like that's a worthless attempt. And what I recognized was there's all these stories that there's a much better way to read them. There's a much more honest way to read them, a much more intelligent way to read them, a much more biblical way to read them. And I thought, okay, if we're gonna do the Noah story right, we have to talk about genre. We have to talk about how to read ancient literature. We have to tell the stories of the neighbors. We need to know what's in those stories. We really should know what comes before it and what comes after it and how those things are connected. We really should talk about violence and what do we do with the violence stories. Like all of those things that are way more than a single sermon can address. And so I thought, you know what, let's just do a Bible study. That's the Genesis study. It's looking at some of those things. Today, what I want to cover, the question I think maybe we should start with is, so often when it comes to kids in the Noah story, it's how did they get all the animals in the boat? Like, that's the question kids are asking. As adults, the question I find most adults getting stuck in the Noah story is, did it happen? Did it not happen? And both sides have their arguments, right? Both sides have their arguments, but I will watch good people with intelligent arguments never get past the question of did it happen into, okay, well, what does the story have to teach us? And so what I want to look at this morning is, what does the Noah story have to teach us? I hope by the end you'll say, yeah, that's more important than just the did it happen, did it not debate. That has its place, but what does the story have? Why would God have this story in our scriptures for us to wrestle with? So my frame is, I wanna look at four stories. I wanna tell you four stories this morning. I'll be as quick as I can. And then each of these stories is held together by a question, same question. And I think it's that question that is the question that we maybe should be wrestling with most. So four stories held together by a question. Story number one, if we're gonna do the story justice, we have to back up a bit and look at the story that directly precedes this story. So Genesis 1 through 4, a story that we look at a lot here, is the story of creation. Now, we've looked at this a lot. We just did a deep dive into this story, and I talked about chiasm. Remember, some of you heard the chiasm sermon, and it's just a fancy word that means like an X. And we looked at poetry and how it fits. So we're not gonna rehash all of that, but for the sake of understanding the Noah story, let's just rehash a little bit of that. If you weren't here, I think it was sometime in January. You can look it up. I think we talked about it then. But just to rehash the sermon. So The story starts, Genesis 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Now that word Spirit of God is the Hebrew word ruach. Ruach means, could be translated wind, breath, or spirit. Now again, pretend you have to draw this. What do you draw? I'm probably drawing like, the easiest to draw. I don't know how to draw spirit, and breath is really hard, and like maybe, but like the wind, maybe the motion of like the like those things. Maybe you could draw wind, and then what else would you draw? What's something in here you could draw? Waters, maybe? So let's just, I'm not going to draw this morning, but let's just write wind and waters, plural. Now, the story continues. There are 7 days of creation. Let's just go quickly through these. Day one, God says, let there be light, and he separates it from dark. So from, what's called, well, no, I'll write dark. Light and dark, or day and night. And then day two, God separates water below from water above, sea and sky. But the technical language is water above from water below. And then day three separates water from land. Land! Exclamation point. There's land. Now, this is where we like did the chiasm last time, and you said, hey, days one through three are, it's separation language, and then God fills. Is this jogging any memories? Okay. But day four is what? Yeah, sun, moon, the greater lights and the lesser lights is what it says. Sun, moon, and stars. And then day five, birds and fish. Birds. Fish. Day six, animals and people. And then, by the way, God says what to the animals and the people? Be fruitful and multiply. So let's put that, I'm running out of whiteboard. I also struggle to spell on a whiteboard. Is that a thing, teachers? Be fruitful and multiply. to both the animals and to the people. And then day seven is rest, which is a sign that God is present with us. And then the next story is, I'm just going to write it out, is of a garden. Adam and Eve are in a garden. And then there is sin. And then that sin under them grows. And then following that is a curse. And it's like times two, because you get the same thing then with their kids, right? So Cain and Abel then sin again, and then there's a curse on Cain. But before there's a curse, the reason there's a curse is because Cain kills his brother. And the question he asks before the curse is, am I my bro's keeper? Am I my brother's keeper? That's the question. So that's the first story. Any questions on the first story? First story. So Genesis 1 through 4, that's like a clear flyover of the story. But that's the first story. Now, I want to jump into the second story, the story of Noah. And just for we'll set the stage for the story. The story begins with people are sinning, right? We know the story. People are sinning, and God doesn't like that they're sinning. God says, I got to like fix this. Noah's a righteous man, blameless in the sight of the Lord. So God says, Noah, I'm going to spare you and your family if you build a boat. Noah gets to work building a boat. They get in a boat. Two of every kind of animal go in the boat with them. There's a few more of the sacrificial animals. They join the boat. Then it rains for 40 days and 40 nights. The rainwater stays. They cover the whole earth, everything. And then the water stays for 150 days. And then it begins to recede. Now, let's pick that story up there in chapter 8. Chapter 8. What I want you to be listening for in this is what feels like a sequel. Like what feels like, okay, we've already heard this. It's because it's almost like God's starting creation again. So pay attention to what feels like a sequel. Verse 1. But God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and the livestock that were with him in the ark, and he set a wind over the earth, and the waters receded. You catching it? Sequel. We've got wind and waters. You probably can't read any of this, but wind and waters. Now, let's see if it keeps playing out. So initially, you have this immediate, like, wow, this is how the story started. It's been wiped clean, but now we're starting back, and it's with water again, and it's with wind again. Now, the springs of the deep and the floodgates of the heavens had been closed, and the rain had stopped falling from the sky. So it was dark and raining, and now the storm clouds are moving, and now we've got some light. But beyond that, if you notice how the water is described, there is water above and water below. We think of the flood as it rained and rained and rained, but actually it says that the water rose from below and from above. Day two stuff. Now, verse 3. The water receded steadily from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the water had gone down, and on the 17th day of the seventh month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. The waters continued to recede until the 10th month, and on the first day of the 10th month, the tops of the mountains had become visible. Land. By the way, this is a real deep in the weeds, which we'll go someday if you join me. But if you notice in this passage, you have 17th day of the seventh month, on the first day of the 10th month, you get that like month and day and month and day. Do you remember in the first story why the sun, moon, and stars? Why God says, I'm giving you the sun, moon, and stars? They will mark the what? The time, right? So the moon will mark a month, and the sun will mark the day. This is how we tell time. Days and months. It's like the story is repeating itself. After 40 days, verse 6, Noah opened a window he had made in the ark, and he sent out a raven, and it came flying back and forth until the water had dried up from the earth. A raven is a? Then he sent out a dove to see if the water had receded from the surface of the ground, but the dove could not find anywhere to perch because there was water over the surface of the earth. So it returned to Noah in the ark. He reached out his hand, and he took the dove, and he brought it back to himself in the ark. He waited 7 more days, and again sent out the dove from the ark. When the dove returned to him in the evening, There in its beak was a freshly plucked olive leaf. The land is producing vegetation, just like it, the first story. Then Noah knew that the water had receded from the earth. He waited 7 more days, and he sent the dove out again. But this time, it did not return to him. By the first day of the first month of Noah's 601st year, the water had dried up from the earth. Noah then removed the covering from the ark, and he saw that the surface of the ground was dry. By the 27th day of the second month, the earth was completely dry. Then God said to Noah, "Come out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons and your daughter, you and your sons and their wives. Bring out every kind of living creature that is with you, the birds, the animals, and all the creatures that move along the ground, so they can multiply on the earth and be fruitful and increase in number on it." So Noah came out together with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives, all the animals and all the creatures that move along the ground and all the birds. Everything that moves on land came out of the ark, one kind after another. Now, what language do we have? We have animals and people and be fruitful. In fact, in chapter 9, that's exactly the language. Be fruitful and increase in number, or be fruitful and multiply. It's as though it's repeating. If you keep reading, the next story we're going to bump into is God's going to give a sign that he's present with them. We call it the rainbow. God's war weapon is perched up in the clouds. There's a fascinating connection between the rainbow and the Sabbath, not for today. But the next thing is a sign. Then following the sign, there's a less known story. There is a story. So if the original was garden, following this moment, there is a story of of Noah planting a vineyard. He then gets really drunk in the vineyard. He passes out in the vineyard. And then there's a story of his son coming in and castrating him. You're thinking, wait, I don't remember that point of the story. It doesn't say that that's what happened, but that's totally what happened. I will show you. Again, not for today. That's a teaser. It's pretty wild. It's pretty hard to deny too. Anyway, it's a moment in the story. And all of a sudden, whether it was castration or just he saw him naked and that was the thing. But there's a moment in the story where then he realizes what has happened, and he declares a curse. So there's sin. He declares a curse over not his son, but his son's son, a guy by the name of Canaan. So the first curse was Cain. Second curse is Canaan. It's pretty hard to deny that this is it's almost like a retelling of the first story. And just in case you're not convinced, verse 20 of chapter 9 says this: Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. That phrase, a man of the soil, in Hebrew, the way you say the word man is ish. Let me say ish. Ish. Man is ish. Woman is isha. Isha. Ish. A man of the soil. Of the soil, say Adam. Adam is how they would say. But ish Adam. Ish Adam. Literally, the passage reads, Noah, the Adam man, proceeded to plant a garden, a vineyard. It's like the author wants you to say, hey, the story's happening again. The problem was the first story ended in curse, sin just escalating and growing. The second story ends exactly the same. Noah, Adam 2.0, the story ends the same. Which brings us to our third story. Abraham, story number 3. Genesis 12, we're introduced to a guy named Abram. Later, he'll be Abraham. And Abraham, we know, will succeed where they don't succeed. Why do we know this? Because most of the world today will trace their faith lineage back to Abraham, right? Most of the world has Abraham as part of our story. Hebrew people, Jews, trace their roots to Abraham. But it's not just our Jewish friends. Christians, we trace our roots back to Abraham through his son Isaac. And Muslims trace their lineage back to Abraham through his son Ishmael. I think you can make a strong case that Hindus would trace their roots back to, could trace their roots back to Abraham. The way you say, so Hebrew has no vowels, it's just consonants. So the name Abraham is just B-R-H-M, B-R-H-M. Which, by the way, what's the chief god of Hinduism? Brahma. That doesn't really matter. Most of the world, though, will trace their roots back. Father Abraham will have many sons. Many sons will have Father Abraham. Not Father Noah. So that raises the question. Okay, is this what the Jewish people are saying with, okay, Noah was not a hero? What did Noah do? Or what did Abraham do different? Why does he succeed? Is it because he's perfect? Noah wasn't a good guy. Abraham's a good guy. Noah pawns off his wife on the Pharaoh twice. Dude's not perfect. So What does Abraham do differently than Noah? Noah's a good guy. We're told he's a good guy. He has a moment of weakness. Sure, who doesn't? But he's a good guy. So what does Abraham do that's different? I want to argue that what he does different is he answers this question, am I my brother's keeper, with a yes. Noah does not. Adam does not. In fact, baked into the charge given to Abraham in Genesis 12 is this charge. This is your responsibility. This is what it says. The Lord had said to Abram, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Question. Does God bless Adam? Say yes. Yes. Does God bless Noah? Say yes. Does God bless Abraham? Yes. What's different? God makes it really clear with Abraham, you're not just blessed because I like you better. You're blessed to bless. The purpose of your blessing isn't just to know that you're like loved by God, you're saved by God. The purpose of your blessing is to know that so that you can also extend God's love, extend God's kingdom to others. Your purpose is to be a brother, your brother's keeper. Now, when you look at the life of Abraham, he gets it. So Adam sins. He eats the fruit, and God confronts the sin, and Adam's response is, she made me do it. He blames. Noah is told that the world is going to drown. God's mad because everyone's sinning. Noah's response is, okay, I better get to work and build that boat. Abraham, story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham's told by God, the city of Sodom and Gomorrah is not righteous. We're going to destroy the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham's response is, no, you're not. No, God, how dare you? The exact language is, far be it for you to destroy them. What if there's righteous people in there? What would they say about you? They would think you're like this mean and nasty. What would they say about you? Abraham gets in God's face and says, no. I'm my brother's keeper. He gets it. Abraham has this moment where three strangers will come to Abraham, and he has just been circumcised. He's sitting under a tree because he's 99 years old and has been circumcised, which is an operation that I assume takes a while to recover from. And he's sitting under a tree, and he sees these three strangers, and he runs to the strangers. He makes them way more bread than anyone could ever eat. Take it with you, he says. Now, again, I'm my brother's keeper. Noah, in a very similar like opportunity, people mock him. He could explain what's going on. I'm doing this to save the world. I'm like, join me. But instead, he ignores them. It's not a bad thing. Like, he doesn't fight back against them. He doesn't see a responsibility. Another example. Adam is not present when Cain is cursed. He's just not there. Noah is actually the one who says the curse over Canaan. And then you get to Abraham. Abraham is standing with his nephew Lot, who Abraham is the firstborn. He should get to choose the land. But instead he says to his nephew, you choose first, I'll take what's left. What's different? It's almost like God says, it's not that Noah's bad. It's not that Adam's bad. But Abraham's got a heart that I can build I can tell my story using this guy. Because this guy's pulling everyone's story forward. Story number four. In 2009, I went to Israel for the first time. I was just a young man. I was in the back. I went with a, so I'm in the middle there, in the back with my hat turned backwards like a cool guy. Anyway, that's in Israel. I went with a guy by the name of Ray Vanderlaan. Have you heard of Ray Vanderlaan? I've talked about him before because he was huge in my story. He's crouched in the middle right over here. And most of the people there, I was a chaperone. There's a few chaperones. Most of them were the high school graduating class, so they're like 18-year-old high school students. And we were in, so one of the ways you learn in Israel, by the way, to say that this trip changed my life is to undersell it. Like, this changed everything for me, this experience. But the way you learn in Israel is you learn with your feet. The way a rabbi will often teach is with your feet. You'll notice this with Jesus. Like, he'll lead his disciples. He'll have them go all the way down to the Jerusalem area. And then he'll say, hey, go back home to Galilee. So they go all 90 miles back home to Galilee. And then in Galilee, he gives them two lines, which is the Great Commission. It's all about the journey. It's all about the journey. You learn with your feet. And so one of the ways our rabbi, Ray Vanderlaan, was teaching us this was he had us in the desert. And so we were walking around the desert in circles, because that's the story. And by the way, if you walk in the desert in circles, you have a little bit of compassion for the Israelites who complained. Like, we were complaining pretty quickly. And they made it a lot longer than we did without complaining. And we were walking in the desert. It was like 110 degrees. It was one of those days where your shirt's sticking to you. It's like Friday. It's like one of those days. And so we're walking, and it's hot. And we brought enough water because they warned us ahead of time. But it's like, even that, we're like, is there going to be enough water? Where's our bus? And off in the distance, we see a tent. And it's like a big old tent, right? It's like, okay, this is not just an individual tent. It's like a big old tent. And he stops us and he says, okay, this appears to be a Bedouin village. Bedouins, and then he goes on to explain what the Bedouins are. Bedouins are mostly Muslim villages that still live a lot like Abraham would have lived. They're nomads. They will wander from place to place. Every once in a while you bump into them. You could go for months without seeing them. But they'll kind of move the tent from place to place, often desert, often shepherds in the desert. And so we see this village. He explains, like, this is mostly Muslim, kind of, but they live very, like, close to the way the biblical people would have lived, very simple lives. So immediately, he could, like, read our face because we're worried. And he says, you know, honestly, we shouldn't have anything to worry about. We shouldn't have anything to worry about. But you know what? Out of respect for other cultures, let's just keep our distance. We'll just respect them. But then he said, okay, but let's just try something. Let's just move a little bit closer and let's just see. And so we move a little bit closer, and sure enough, out comes running the cutest kids, like just the cutest little kids. And they come running up to us, and I hate Babel. I couldn't understand what they were saying because they spoke a different language, but they were waving us back, and they come back to our tent, come back to our tent. And so our VL, Ray Vanderlaan, said, okay, here's what's going to happen. We're going to go back to their tent, and most likely they're going to feed you something. And it's going to probably be pretty okay. Like, it's probably going to be some kind of a bread thing. And then what we had was actually like a sweet coffee. I didn't like it, but that's what they made us. And he's like, okay, but they're going to produce this. And as they're making this, you're going to realize they don't have a lot. Like, you'll just look around and be like, they got a couple camels and a couple like mules. They don't have a lot. And so everything in you is going to want to pay them for what they're doing. Give them something. And he said, don't do it. You will steal them of their dignity. Don't do it. Let them serve you. Let them serve you. So we go back, and there's this beautiful woman. She's serving. She's already started making food because the kids had run back, and she's making this bread on this like hot stone thing, and she's making this bread for us to eat, and like the kids are helping pour these drinks, and I guess the guys were out in the field. I have no idea, but the guys weren't there. It was just them. Her name was Hadassah. Never forget this woman. She's baking us this food. We're playing with the kids. Like, the kids are like sitting on our lap, and we're playing with these kids and some game that was kind of like soccer and kind of like kick the can. I have no idea what we're playing, but we were playing. And Hadassah's making us this food. And we're like, most of the trip is We're on site. Here's a biblical lesson. In this place it happened. Like, mind-blowing stuff. This was a very different kind of experience from that. It's a very human, very divine kind of experience. And so we leave, and Ray Vanderland says, as we're getting back on the bus, and he explains to us, he's like, I know that right now what you're feeling is joy and love. You should feel that. And he said, but every time one of these kinds of experience happens, every time I meet somebody in a Bedouin village, Abraham's people, I get a bit sad. And he goes, here's what's going to happen. You're going to go home, and you're going to remember this trip. And at some point, you're going to go back home, and you're going to look around your neighborhood, and you're going to wonder, why don't we do that? Why is it that we often choose Noah's way, self-preservation, over Abraham's way? And as we were driving, I couldn't help but think, yeah, if I were to think about my neighbor, what would happen? We were 50-some, 40-some Americans wearing American clothes with backpacks on, walking up to somebody else's tent. What would happen in our neighborhoods if 50 Muslims wearing backpacks in their native clothes were to walk into your neighborhood? How would we respond? I've heard the phrase faith over fear used so much that I think we've lost the meaning of it. But how many of us, like, I honestly, like, if it was my neighborhood, like, where is my faith? That's been my question. The fear of the unknown, the fear of the stranger, the person we don't understand, the person we've heard stories about, like, the fear of that to keep us from actually living the way of Christ. And I felt what Ray Vanderland was telling us he felt, which was a deep sadness. Like, it's so easy. It's so easy to live in the, I have to protect what's mine, and to sacrifice the heart of Abraham. And that, for me, is why I think this story is so much more important for us to wrestle with than just the, did this happen or did this not happen? That's a question. We'll wrestle with that question. But far more important, it's really easy to wrestle with that and to dismiss what the story actually needs us to confront. Do we have the heart of Abraham? Do I have the heart of Abraham, or have I chosen the heart of Noah? This story, early in the scriptures, needs to remember, there's one of those stories. It's not that Noah's a bad guy. He's not. We're told explicitly he's not a bad guy. But God will not write his divine story off of Noah's story. Noah will play a blip role in it, and then he'll fade away. But Father Abraham will live on. Why? Because Abraham understood that he has a responsibility. His life is not just about advancing his story. History is made by advancing all of those we have the opportunity to bump into in this life, all of their story. Now, what I love about this story, and what I find really convicting about this story, is it reminds us that just because God saves us doesn't mean God will use us. I know it's not very peace. Let me say that again. Just because God saves you doesn't mean God will use you. That's not a very politically correct thing to say. I get it. What we want to hear is God loves and uses everybody. And it's certainly true that God loves everybody, right? But God doesn't use everybody. It's just not true. You can tell very quickly there are certain people in your world that God uses in really astounding ways. I was at a funeral last week of a 23-year-old girl. I think it's okay to say her name. Kate Velding. Do you know Kate Velding? Kate was 23. She had a genetic disease. But she lived a life that most of us will live a fraction of a life to what this incredible young woman lived. It's a powerful life, because she understood her whole life that she didn't have long, and so she lived it. She would often sit right there, and she was a person I would look to when I was, like, feeling stuck in a sermon. I would look to her because she would remind me, like, it's okay. Just because God will save us, and he'll save us, but there's so much more. We could be used. And what we see in the Abraham story is a heart that says, God, use me. One last thing. Let's talk about the fur coat. I promise you, I'll tell you a story about the fur coat. The Midrash says that the reason God doesn't use Noah in the same way. The reason Noah's not a hero is because Noah wore a fur coat. And the point is to tell a story like that and have the endless debate of what do they mean. The most dominant understanding of what the rabbis meant is that there are seasons in life when life gets difficult, when the winter comes, when the storms hit, when it gets cold. And in those seasons, people will do one of two things. They will either build a fire so that everyone can come near and get warm, or they will put on a fur coat so that they themselves can stay warm while everybody around them freezes. Noah saves himself. He puts on a fur coat. Abraham builds a fire. And the invitation out of this story is that we continue to inspect our own hearts and say, God, where have I chosen the fur coat over the fire? And then to remember the words of Jesus, our Jesus chooses to often meet us in the least likely places, the places we're not looking, the poor, the orphan, the widow, the stranger. And so if we want an encounter with God himself, we become our brother's keeper. Would you join me in a word of prayer? Lord, as we celebrate this morning, this church and the work you have us, the path you have us on, the work that's in front of us to do, Lord, as we celebrate your mission in this world, as we, Lord, as we look around a fractured world and we try to figure out how to walk forward, Lord, we are reminded, Lord, that you are with us in this and that you long to meet us in the least likely places. Lord, would you remind us of our responsibility? Lord, would you remind us that when we do the hard things, life often becomes hard. That's the story of the cross. Lord, would you remind us of that? And yet, Lord, would you so fill us with a joy in serving that it far surpasses the pain of the moment. King Jesus, we love you and we thank you and we pray this in your name. And everybody said, amen.
As always, we're grateful that you would spend a little time with us. For more information about South Harbor Church, joining our community, or any of the things you hear on the podcast, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m., you'll find our service streamed live on both our Facebook page and on our Vimeo channel, which you can find by visiting vimeo.com/South Harbor Church. And so once again, from all of us here at South Harbor and the Harbor Churches, we want to wish you a blessed week.